we don't give the police the sanction to go out and harass people. Because that's... it destroys people's rights. But people's friends are kind of fear from the broader community. Because police, unfortunately, tend to accrete power. You know, they believe and they thrive on not so much respect, but on fear, I'm afraid. That's been my experience with them, although I have many good things to say about individual cops. And people, police are all human beings at one level or another. But once police officers enter the police force system, just as individual Nazis may be fine people, but when they enter the party system or individual... any individuals who enter an organization and start submerging their individuality on behalf of that collective purpose of that organization then bear the responsibility for what that organization does. And I can only speak to the actions of the organization, the police force, here in Santa Cruz. A lot of people told me, well, you know, those are just human guys, they're just people. And it's true, you should relate to police officers as human beings, but you also have to remember that they have... accepted the dominance of this blue ethic, you know, whether it's a code of silence, whether it's even some of the best cops, I've seen them lying on the stand. Yes, lying on the stand, you know, certainly seemed to me to be lying on the stand in cases of trivial cases involving homeless people. It's really, I guess it's a form of corruption where cops are just trying to protect their fellow officers or get convictions or meet quotas. And if you're interested in fighting this kind of abuse, I encourage you to give a call to my organization, HUFF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, 423-HUFF. And again, getting back to Berkeley, you know, we have a situation where merchant associations don't mind police crackdowns on the poor, but are now seeking greater exemptions for people who are not poor. And that's double standard, as we say. And also, I would say much of the abusive conduct from drunkenness comes from expanded alcohol use. Compliments of merchants who, you know, after all, are engaged in encouraging people to buy liquor. I mean, you know, homeless people who drink beer are not running around telling everybody to drink. But restaurants and bars downtown are. I mean, that's part of their livelihood. I mean, they're not telling everyone to drink, but they advertise for that. They're set up to make it comfortable and convenient and with the predictable results, which you'll see on July 4th. You want to check out what alcohol does. And I don't mean, I'm not talking about heroin, cocaine, methamphetamines, LSD, or grass. I'm talking about the biggest scourge, actually the second biggest killer, drug killer in this country, alcohol. The first is nicotine, cigarettes. That kills over 400,000 people a year through diseases. Alcohol is sort of second. I think it's, what, 150 to 200,000 in accidents and illnesses and violence and so forth. But it, of course, is illegal and in many cases subsidized and supported by the government. Tobacco certainly is, and alcohol is a major industry. So, what's happening in Berkeley that affects poor people that we can learn something from? What more can I tell you about Cornerstone Carol Denny's reports? Well, the Downtown Business Association up there has gotten cumulatively $500,000 in public money over the last 5 years, according to Carol. This year, they're getting $115,000. And what did they do with this money? Well, they gave huge raises to their executive directors. They spin-offs of other sorts. They give the jobs to consultant contracts to friends of the Downtown Business Association. In their own annual report, according to Carol Denny, they said their number one job was to lobby City Council on behalf of Bank of America, Wells Fargo, corporations who were large property owners in many cases, corporations represented by large property owners. They would call merchant organizations. Regular merchants were threatened with losing their leases if they didn't join the Downtown Business Association in this lobbying. Pressure was deliberately put on residents in downtown hotels, threatening them with their living space, to get them to pass anti-homeless laws. This, I also saw this phenomenon in Santa Cruz. There were some merchants who did not like the downtown laws that Neil Coonerty and Cat and Canary and Atlantis Fantasy World and Game-A-Lot and Staff Alive were pushing. I say Staff Alive, that may surprise some people. It's one of the organizations on the boycott list that I continue to encourage people to boycott with an active boycott. Don't just not go into these stores, walk into these stores and say, I will change my shopping policies in Santa Cruz when Santa Cruz changes its anti-homeless laws and you change your policy of supporting a law that makes it a 6-month jail term offense to peacefully ask someone for spare change twice after dark. That is a completely irrational and violent law, which is really an attempt to intimidate a whole bunch of people. It has no business being in Santa Cruz. And you and your store advocated for that law, and that's wrong. And I'm not going to shop at your store while that's happening, but I sure would love to stop and shop at your store if you could change your policies around that. And that's what I encourage you to do with these stores. And Staff Alive, unfortunately, though it contributes food to Food Not Bombs, it's commendable and has for years, is also responsible for the destruction of the Triangle Park across from its store. They walled it off. They turned it into a little, green area where you can't get in because they didn't like the drunks hanging out there, the drunks and the bums. Again, it's this idea that you're going to pretty everything up and clean things up and by removing areas from public space, by removing people from public areas, is completely wrong on a number of grounds. It's abusive of human rights. It's no solution. It violates what I consider to be the basic ambiance of Santa Cruz. And it's extremely arrogant and monopolistic, the idea that merchant stores somehow have the right to usurp public spaces in that way. There have to be other more creative solutions. There are other more creative solutions. And we must oppose police solutions to these problems. Anyway, getting back to Berkeley, Carol Denny's report, Cornerstone Carol Denny's report, is that the Downtown Business Association, just like our own Downtown Association, tried to forward the mythology that panhandling, not high rents, was killing the downtown area. Whereas, in fact, according to Carol, high rents are what's doing it. Businesses are going out of business because the rent tripled up there. Two more coffee houses in Berkeley and drugstores are going out of business. And the old Italian coffee house at Euclid and Hearst is going out of business. Another on the south side. And what's happening is the property owners are passing on fancy fees to the renters, in this case, the small business owners. Chain stores are the only ones who can pay for these improvements. And so the downtown business associations here and in Santa Cruz are passing laws that lure the chain stores, the most reactionary stores, the stores that even Neil Coonerty has been fighting as far as sign size, Barnes & Noble downtown. And what we get is a bunch of greed heads running the policies of the downtown and rewriting the Constitution for their own benefit. And it's despicable. And a little humorous. But more, probably a little of both. The Downtown Business Association in Berkeley, according to Carol, fought against anti-chain store legislation. They got it watered down. They exempted downtown from it because chain stores can pay the highest rents. What else is happening up in Berkeley? Well, there's been a lot of interest for some of us around the University of California, a mega corporation, if there ever was one, and its attempt to continually expand, and pasteurize, homogenize, gentrify, and liquefy opposition to its policies, and particularly around, I'm going to talk again about People's Park. That's a small park area about 4 blocks from the university on Telegraph Avenue, which has been there for 30 years. It was created in the late 60s by citizens, activists, environmentalists, poor people, out of a essentially a hole in the ground that the university had created because it destroyed low-income housing in 1967 to drive out hippies and bohemians, but then put nothing else there. When people created a community park, the university moved in to try to destroy that park, and they enlisted then-Governor Ronald Reagan and the state, sent in the National Guard, blinded one man and killed another, beat dozens, tear-gassed a city, held a city in hostage for a month. But People's Park survived. People tore down the fence. People tore out the concrete. The university recently has been attempting more assaults on this. In 91, they built a series of sports courts on the park. Again, the motivation was not to assist the community, but to gentrify the park and essentially to remove homeless people. Even more recently, they've admitted in documents that what they're trying to do is remove the free clothing service, relocate, possibly 10 miles off the coast, the free meal service, which is done by Food Not Bombs and I believe another group as well, and engage again in a series of changes that remove the park from local control and put it under the university's control, and hopefully it'll be turned into an area that appeals to upper middle class white students and perhaps a theme park, you know, who knows. But that's being fought by those who've always used the park, who have a strong commitment to it. There is a use committee meeting that's often called a useless committee meeting. I think it's University Services. I'm not quite sure what the name means, but that's happening up in Berkeley next Wednesday, day after tomorrow. And if you're interested, if you happen to be in Berkeley and you want to attend that meeting, give me a call at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. And if any of what I'm saying is being listened to or is being objected to, I want you to give me a call here at Free Radio Santa Cruz at 427-3772. For the next hour, that's where I'm going to be, here on Bathrobes Pier's Broadsides. That's what you're listening to. A bi-weekly show, Monday and Friday from 10 to 12. Well, locally, what else have we got? We got the Civilian Police Review Board, which is, as I frequently said, a pretty pathetic commentary on the results of a lot of hard activist work by dozens of people to bring issues of police abuse to the community's attention. What the City Council has done is it's funded a group without any real review powers that are, in terms of independent investigator. There's no funded investigator, there's no independence of the city manager, there's no prosecutorial power, there's no power to assure open public hearings. And what you also recently have had, as I've mentioned in previous shows, is you have a board which can't even get a copy of the complaint from the police department. They have to kind of chain gang over to the police department, be watched by a police officer while they read the complaint, and then kind of hop back to their office. They can get a description of a complaint from the police department. They're very nice. The police department will tell them about the complaint, but they won't give them a copy of the complaint because they're claiming that's a part of the confidential personnel file of the police department. This is a tiny issue. The general dimensions of this commission make it a joke. And the membership of the commission, which includes such individuals as the Kennedy appointee, who is doing his best to hamstring the commission, as far as I can see from the meetings I've attended, make it even more of a joke. You actually have police officers sitting up there looking like they're on the commission. They're off to the side. But they're not, unlike the rest of the audience, they don't sit in the audience. They're sitting up there on the dais with the Civilian Police Review Board. They went through two complaints on a week ago Monday, doing this little do-si-do dance of going over to the police department. And according to the Mercury News article I read, and according to one police review board member whom I contacted, John Malkin, they found, you know, the two complaints are unsubstantiated. They threw them out. Actually, that's not quite completely accurate, but in essence, they didn't find any basis for disciplining any police officers or recommending any policy changes that I remember. The complaints that were made and resolved are not yet public record, so we can't even read them, we the public members. That question is still being discussed by the board, which is still a year after the enabling legislation was passed, more than a year, has not yet gotten down to finalizing its procedures. Members on the board and cops are pressuring that complaints, even after they're resolved, not be made public. What this means, by the way, for anybody listening who has filed any of the complaints, is you have to make these complaints not merely to the police department, to the board, but you have to make them publicly available. And one way to do that is perhaps we could establish a file at the library. Perhaps you could do it through an advocacy group like SPAN, Stop Police Abuse Now, who can be contacted through 475-2012, through HUF, the group that I work with, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, at 423-HUF. Right now, as they will do, the police department and its legal hit team are playing games and pressing on to make sure that even this emasculated shadow of a board is further emasculated. Kind of almost like a power trip that has no point because they've been successful. Why be embarrassingly obvious about how ineffectual this board is? Police departments continue to amaze me. I saw the police reacting in the most incredible way in San Francisco, and I was up there last week. Actually, it was 2 weeks ago when police, literally dozens and occasionally hundreds of cops, came out to arrest Food Not Bombs members and stop Food Not Bombs demonstrations up there, simply to prove that they had the power, it seemed to me. They weren't reacting to violence. They weren't reacting to complaints. They were just being cops with nightsticks and guns and filling the jails. And by the way, all the charges in San Francisco, every charge has been dropped. Every charge of the more than 440 people arrested in that week period during the first UN 50th anniversary celebration in San Francisco a week or two ago, every charge has been dropped. And to me, that means 439 false arrests, because that's what the police were doing and have done, I've noticed, over the years up there habitually, without any kind of check from the courts or the mayor or commissions or generally the community or other organizations, which is they've arrested people for serving free food, and even though the DA drops all the charges and announces they're not going to prosecute, next day cops are out there arresting again. That's what we call a police state. That's what we call fascism, where the law has no check over the policies of the police department, where their decisions and their discretion is unbridled, where they decide what's legal and what's illegal. That's happening in San Francisco, or it certainly was through the end of last week. Now, I actually got an interesting report from Food Not Bombs co-founder and activist Keith McHenry up there, who I spoke to yesterday on the phone. He says that, contrary to what I expected, and I expected police to really go after Food Not Bombs, the organization that feeds people twice daily in San Francisco at UN Plaza at 6 in the evening and at noon, in violation of a court order and in violation of the police department's wishes, but to fulfill its commitment to get people food and also to make poverty visible and to expose the totally ineffectual, hypocritical policies of the city and its repressive matrix policies, which have arrested thousands and thousands of people for lifestyle crimes in the form of homeless cleansing. Keith's report was that Food Not Bombs has not been harassed. There have been no arrests, no food confiscations, no cops grabbing soup and throwing it in the gutter, grabbing bagels and throwing them all over the sidewalk and stomping on them, no seizures of vehicles and bicycles that brought in the bagels, no undercover cops fingering and assaulting people in crowds and then dragging them off to paddy wagons claiming that they previously served food and therefore are criminals. So it could be, Keith's impression is, that the city may really be embarrassed by the bad press that happened around the Mumia Abu-Jamal Food Not Bombs demonstrations of last week. In this demonstration, over 280 people were arrested when they marched at a candlelight, torchlit parade up, I guess it was up Market, up Valencia, to protest the execution, the coming murder of Mumia Abu-Jamal in August in Pennsylvania, who was a Black Panther and a MOVE activist, falsely accused of murdering a police officer in Philadelphia. When the Food Not Bombs people marched 280 strong, or no, they marched, actually there were more, 500 or 600, if not more, people. They were, even by reports in the newspapers, which is very rare, Food Not Bombs arrests don't usually receive media coverage because, well, Chronicle and the Examiner don't consider it newsworthy, and then there are those who claim that Chronicle and Examiner are run by the same corporate guys who are actually encouraging the mayor to press on with his anti-homeless programs downtown, and therefore may have some influence on what the Chronicle and Examiner reports and what they don't report. But this march, this Mumia Abu-Jamal march, was cornered by the police, driven into an alleyway, and then they started arresting people. There was no charge, no megaphoned statement to the crowd that they should disperse or be arrested. They were simply arrested, one after another after another, after they had separated the media so the media could not record the arrest with video film and cameras and visual eyewitness reporting. And what they did was they, by the reports of several people, including Red Top Robert Flurry, who I believe has spoken to you about this, he's a Santa Cruz activist who was arrested last Tuesday that this happened. It was Tuesday or Monday night that this happened a week ago. He was arrested when what the police would do is they would tell everyone to get off the street onto the sidewalk, and they would baton them onto the sidewalk, and there were some beatings that happened. And then they would arrest them for blocking the sidewalk without any kind of failure to disperse. And of course, this policy was so inappropriate and had so little legal sanction that then they charged everybody with crimes like arson. There were three charges. Two of them were felonies. Arson, that was because certain people lit dumpster fires. And the claim of some of the activists I talked to, no activist I talked to has talked about lighting a dumpster fire. They did have torches, but it was for a torchlight parade. Somebody else lit the dumpster fires before they arrived there, is what I heard. But even if they had, lighting on fire a dumpster in a situation which is not particularly dangerous as far as anything spreading anywhere else, and happens in street demonstrations in different places, is not, in my mind, tantamount to arson. And that apparently is the case for the, is what the DA's office in San Francisco believes too, because according to the June 30th, 95 Examiner, marchers won't be charged for now. Prosecutor needs more evidence. San Francisco DA will not prosecute for now any of the 278 people arrested during a Mission District protest march in which four dumpsters were set ablaze and seven police cars damaged. Cummings, Assistant District Attorney Paul Cummings, said he was not pressing charges because I didn't think we were going to have what I needed. If I ever will have what I need to prosecute my case, my burden of proof is much higher than a police officer has to have to make an arrest. I have to say clearly who did what. And he's soliciting videotapes. Obviously, it's not spontaneous. He says he's soliciting videotapes taken by citizens and TV photographers that might lead to prosecution of those who set fires in dumpsters around 15th and Valencia. Obviously, it's not spontaneous combustion, but there's not 278 people setting fires yet. 278 people apparently were charged with arson, with riot, and, of course, with blocking the sidewalk. This is a policy which Santa Cruz police also use, although I have to say, both to their credit and to their detriment, District Attorney's Office, which would, in San Francisco, arrest people for serving free food, the cops would arrest people, and then the charges would all be dropped. Here in Santa Cruz, they actually prosecuted people for doing this. And almost all those cases were thrown out. I was prosecuted for serving free food. I mean, I was charged, and then they dropped the charges. Linda Edwards was charged. Dozens of people were charged with this, and actually only two people were convicted. One person was acquitted, Jane Immler, after a long trial. Similarly, the two that were convicted were Brian Flanagan Staley and Sandra Loringer, who's still a worker for Food Not Bonds. But the strange thing is that Food Not Bonds in San Francisco is not being harassed at the present time, according to Food Not Bonds member McHenry. That and he also points out that he thinks that part of this has to do with the mayoral campaign, which folks may or may not be aware is heating up in San Francisco. There are a lot of big-name people like Willie Brown and Actonberg and Angela Alioto challenging Mayor Jordan's reign of error and terror up there. And that election is due for November, not too many months away. And there are those who feel that Art Agnos, previous mayor, lost the election because of his actions toward Food Not Bonds, which involved hundreds and hundreds of arrests over a period of 2 years, 3 years, in 1988 through 1990. And the same thing may happen here with Jordan, although the question as to whether a change in the administration will actually result in a change in policy toward Food Not Bonds is a good one. McHenry doesn't think so. I haven't talked to other Food Not Bombers up there on that question. But it's generally open season on the homeless and on those who support them in big cities, and particularly in San Francisco. I mean, San Francisco, actually, we have to say, is the leader in harassment of the homeless and arrests for serving free food. I mean, they have arrested more people for serving free food probably than any other city in the world. And I don't just mean in the last decade. I mean, probably in the last 100 years, although all these arrests have come in the last decade. I mean, if anybody out there is a scholar or archivist or someone who knows more details, I'd love you to get in touch with me to tell me about arrests for free food in other eras within the last 100 years in this country. I mean, it always sounds ridiculous to people. People I tell this story to just start laughing, and they express amazement that people could be arrested for serving free food, you know, unless there's a health issue or something, and there never is. In the cases I've seen, the health issue becomes a pretext. The real issue is a political issue. And the political issue is making sure that the poor are kept out of sight, which is, of course, we have the opposite political agenda, which is making sure the poor are quite visible and quite loud, that the issues are quite clear. So according to McHenry, bigwigs in the DA's office are now begging for negotiations, that there are no court dates on the agenda for people who have been arrested for food serving in the past, which I find quite amazing, and I don't know how accurate this is. Keith, I believe, has a commendable contempt for the court. He himself he pleaded guilty to two felonies, I believe it was two felonies, and took a year's probation, which should be, I think, concluded next February, simply to get out from under an endless series of harassing charges, 40-plus misdemeanors, seven odd felonies, all involving serving free food or distributing literature, Food Not Bombs literature. They actually trumped up a few regarding assault, but the nature of the charges were such that it was obvious these were fabricated charges. It still amazes me, and I still feel a little defensive saying it, because I'm talking to an audience that, how could the police department fabricate a charge? You know, I mean, how could the courts allow it, and so forth? But if the police could continue to arrest people for serving free food after there's only been one conviction in the last 8 years in San Francisco, and only one trial of the hundreds and hundreds, over 1,000 people arrested for that, then they can pretty much do what they want, and they do what they want. I was the only conviction. My case, I was sentenced to 2 months in jail for serving bagels in San Francisco, and that case is still on appeal, and the appeal should be coming down sometime in December. It's going to be re-argued in August on the so-called jurisdictional issue, which is the issue of can a superior court order, which I was convicted under, be modified by a municipal court, which is what my trial judge did. He did not let the jury see certain parts of the order, and the Superior Court wondered if he was overstepping his bounds, and if he was, then I get a new trial and get to go through the whole thing all over again. But if Keith McHenry is correct and they are no longer pursuing Food Not Bombs, then who knows? I may be off the hook. Could be. The problem, though, is that this has happened before. For a year and a half, Mayor Frank Jordan from 1992 through 1993, his first 2 years in office, his year and a half in office, he didn't arrest one Food Not Bombs member. He didn't seize one bagel. Because he was quite aware of what that did to his predecessor, Mayor Art Agnes, and what a can of soup that was, or can of worms that was. But then when he decided to go after poor people, starting with prostitutes in the Union Square area, then with poor people and panhandlers in June of 1993, then clearing out the Transbay Terminal in August of 93, and then his Matrix program, his infamous Matrix Quality of Life program, he renewed his attack on Food Not Bombs, or he started the attack on Food Not Bombs again, and they arrested hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, and since then, I think, what, 500 or 600 people have been arrested since September of 1993. And that's what's happening with that. So, I heard the report that the International Gathering of Food Not Bombs, which happened over the last 2 weeks and attempted to alert the world to UN, to the UN, actually, at its 50th anniversary ceremony to U.S. abuses in terms of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, was a marvelous success. Not only were large numbers of people present to dramatize how repressive San Francisco is and show the world the reality behind the rhetoric in San Francisco, but apparently the impact of all this now is expanded organizing of all kinds of independent Food Not Bombs across the country. There are more than 100 of them across the United States, whereas a couple years ago there were a handful. But San Francisco Food Not Bombs, the one that has been most harassed, most persecuted, is at the moment being left alone because of all this. And let's hope that continues. An update on the Aaron Williams situation. Aaron Williams was the man, you may remember, a lot of the papers in the last month, particularly San Francisco papers, who was beaten by police, black man, beaten by police, and then pepper gassed, and then left to die, and he did die. And there are all kinds of little cover-up investigations happening, and police, you know, they claim the police blows didn't do it, you know, and the pepper gas, well, that certainly was inappropriate that they didn't treat him quickly enough and so forth. But the individuals, one of the main beaters is a previous abuser of citizenry who was kicked off or suspended from a previous police force in the East Bay and picked right up by San Francisco Boys in Blue as one of their finest. And anyway, what's happening there is, according to McHenry, the police story now is that Aaron Williams knew he was facing his third strike, so he came out and fought everybody. He was going to really fight to the death. But the question is, why didn't he walk out the back door and avoid everything instead of walking out the front door to talk with the cops when they decided to beat him up? That question hasn't been answered. And that was kind of the report I got from McHenry. And I'm also interested in local reports. I encourage you, if you are finding strange things happening with the police departments, whether they be the city police, sheriffs and deputies, parks and rangers, the characters who patrol the beaches, private security guards in brown, or the little green shirts downtown who are always smiling at us, give a call to 423-HUFF. That's Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. And let me know your experiences. I also want to invite critics to call in, whether these be critics on the extreme right, critics on the left, critics in the center. I got a phone call from an old friend who apparently suffered some abuse on what he felt was abuse when he called into another program here at 89.3 FM Free Radio Santa Cruz. And I felt personally sympathetic, and I haven't contacted him back yet, and I will talk to him about this. And I guess that my answer, his answer is he wanted to write a letter to the FCC and complain about the station. which I think is the wrong response. I think the best response to abusive speech and behavior is exposure. And that, I think, is the whole rationale for Free Radio Santa Cruz. Instead of less speech, more speech. Instead of closing the door, opening all the doors, and so that in the contest between truth and error, people get to see what's going on, opening up the doors, opening up the airwaves. And I encourage him and anybody else who feels they've been muzzled to give a call either to this radio show, and certainly you're welcome to call this radio show, or any other radio show, and keep calling. I have a tendency to take things personally myself that I wish I didn't have as an activist, because over the years, if you're an activist, you're going to make enemies, not because necessarily you have a personal problem with somebody else, but because they will identify you and they will attack you personally. And the important thing is not to take it personally. So, for instance, I tried to call John Sandich's show 6 months ago, 8 months ago, to announce a demonstration. I did call the show and talked about the sleep out in front of the bookshop Santa Cruz protesting the sleeping ban law back in November, for which we were eventually, three of us were convicted of, improperly convicted, I might add, of sleeping in front of the bookshop, because Sergeant Arrestus admitted he wasn't sure if we were, he knew we weren't asleep, and he wasn't sure what we were covered up with, if anything. And he didn't have that in his report, but Judge Attic found us guilty. Anyway, that's local courts, and typical, and will continue to happen. But I called this radio show KSCO. I don't mind saying its name, even though they do not allow you to say the names of other radio stations on KSCO. I think that's censorship, KSCO, if you're listening, if anybody is listening who is a KSCO listener. Censorship, not a good thing. Call it for advertising purposes, call it whatever. And Sandich, who I've talked to many, many times in the past and has frequently been very helpful in publicizing issues all the way from homeless rights to the crazy drug prohibition wars that the government is waging against the people of the United States and filling the prisons with. Sandich is quite a rational questioner and rational thinker on this ground. I mean, he agrees with me, which is nice, but I think he also is quite articulate and quite good-natured and quite amusing in his way of proceeding on this. And he's also been concerned with homeless rights issues here in the past, in terms of at least allowing activists to have their say on the show Talk About when it was going on up at UCSC. And it may still be going on. It's KZSC, is what I mean, is the student radio station up on campus. We would call in every Wednesday night and talk about the ongoing police shenanigans and city council craziness and around arresting people for being poor. And, you know, it was great. I mean, I regard him as not an ally, at least as sort of a sympathetic critic and certainly a person who allowed people to use his show and his airwaves. But after this November call, he ended this November call by saying to me that I and my pals had driven him out of business in the downtown area. And then he hung up on me. Actually, he let me speak and announce the demonstration, and then he hung up on me. It's back in November, the sleep-out demonstration. And I was kind of shocked, because I wasn't aware that he'd had that opinion, and I tried to call him back, and I got no response from him on that, and I didn't call the station for some time. And then about 2 or 3 months later, I did call the station. It happened to be during his show. He has an afternoon show from 4 to 6, every Monday through Friday on KSCO. And incidentally, there's a lot of talk shows on KSCO. If you can occasionally get into these talk shows, though most of them have the right-wing feel to them. I mean, you have DAG from 12 to 2. It's a Daryl Allen Galt. And then you have Eric Schecht. He's the liberal. He's from 2 to 4. But I actually haven't called Schecht's show, but I used to be familiar with his rather, I felt he was sort of an elitist when he was working at KUSP. He seemed to be supporting city council progressives and their depredations of the homeless. Maybe I'm wrong about him. Anyway, you can call KSCO at 479-1080, and the radio station is 1080 AM. And that's an option you have. A lot of times you can get in, at least for a brief comment before they cut you off. And I called in between 4 and 6 in the afternoon, and I got his call screener, because we don't have call screeners, but they do. And the call screener says, I said, I'm Robert, and I'm talking on homeless issues. And the screener sort of went off the air for a little while and then came back to, is that Robert Norris? And I said, yes. He said, he won't talk to you. He doesn't want to talk to you. And my response was, why? And I've continued to press that question with the station. I can't get a response. The only response I can get from the manager of the station, Michael Zwirling, is that, well, every talk show host makes his own choices, and it's not censorship, it's just a matter of selection, and if you don't like one talk show, try another, you know. And in a way, that's a reasonable thing to say, you know, but my point in all this was that I took it personally. You know, instead of writing John a note or trying to approach him through the third person and say, hey, John, you know, what's cooking here? Or just calling the show again and sort of ignoring this and letting him make a fool of himself by censoring me if he wants to censor me. I took it personally. And it really, it interferes with your activism when you do that. You've got to keep grinning throughout this whole process, or else you're going to fall. You're going to stop. You're going to get wrapped up in personal stuff. I mean, there's already a lot of personal stuff that comes between a homeless activist, because it is such a hard job, and people who are doing it don't get paid to do it. They are under a lot of pressure, whether it's the landlord or the job or police. I mean, it's a lot of things tear people apart in this thing. There's a lot of burnout that happens. And to those activists who are listening, to those people who are interested in fighting for the rights of poor people, and fighting for the rights of all of us, because I believe we are all potentially in that situation, you really have to distance yourself to some extent when you're criticized. And that's something that I've learned intellectually, but I certainly have yet to learn emotionally, and hopefully I will learn that. And it's a lesson that I continue to tell myself I should understand. There are plenty of activists in the community who don't like me. Noel, plenty is perhaps wrong. A number of people. And a number of people who I criticize professionally, like Margaret Marr, the civil liberties attorney who does wonderful work in appeals cases and has been helping homeless people for at least half a decade. Ran into her first back in 1990 when she was working on the Jay Green Linda Edwards case. Jay Green, another activist who died of, it wasn't cancer, he died of Hodgson's disease. He was the mainstay of the post office homeless table, which was the 8.5-month homeless vigil that happened in Santa Cruz in front of the post office starting right after the earthquake here. She took his cases when the police and the DA began charging him with public nuisance, which is a misdemeanor crime punishable by up to 6 months in jail. Anything to frighten and intimidate him from leaving, and he wouldn't leave. He didn't leave until July when he left, when he was offered a deal that actually fell through later on. But there was a hope that there would be some kind of a campground set up, and there wasn't until 3 or 4 years later. And also charges were going to be dropped, but he ended up spending at least a month in jail. So he was sold down the river big time. But anyway, I have problems with some activists who I disagree with, like Margaret Marr, who as I said, was and still is a wonderful civil liberties attorney. And I even have the feeling that had we been able to, we had a parting of the ways when she decided I was a bad influence on the homeless and didn't want me coming to her civilian police review board meetings, and made them private so I couldn't come in, and then when I did come in, she would walk out, and that still goes on to this day, unfortunately. But again, the problem is taking these things personally, taking these things, feeling that somehow you have to be loved by everyone, you have to be included, it's something I've quite never been able to master. And I don't know why I'm going on about it at length. It certainly is not something that I really want to go on to continue discussing for the rest of my time here, which isn't much. We got half an hour. And you are listening to Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 89.3 FM. And the phone number, which I'm going to give you after this call, is available for you to call, and I'll give it to you before the call, 427-3772, and it looks like we actually have a live caller. Hey.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hey, Robert, this is John Stewart.
Hi, John.
I want to disagree with you about this taking things personally. I think that, I take it that the politics are personal, and the political, let's see, how exactly to say this? I don't want to separate my politics from my personal life, not my personal life from my politics or philosophy of life or any of the rest of it. And so I'm going to take things personally when people do things like that, you know? But I don't propose to attack them or get revenge against them. Or get even with them, or get back at them. But as we're trying to continue to make plans and take actions that are caring, based on care, concern, and compassion, working towards changing this society from the two-headed, sexist, racist, class war monster that it is. To allow for us to live and anyway, like that.
Uh-huh.
Anyway.
Well, shall I react to that here?
Sure, go ahead on.
Well, I've always admired you for your ability to expose profound political problems through your